The hour at 1:40 in the date is the 14th of March, 1983. The place is the judiciary hearing room, room 124, located at the Capitol in Juneau, Alaska.
Okay.
Present at the hearing today are all members of the Judiciary Committee. I announced at the close of the meeting last Friday that we were going to continue the hearing on HB 200. One of the things that I've been advised in the clerk's office of doing is that if we're going to continue a bill like that, I must, on the floor, go ahead and, I guess, say something. And I didn't do that today, because the recess today came on me so quickly that I didn't get time enough to run up. I'd like to blame the speaker and say he should ask for announcements.
He did.
Maybe I didn't hear that. I was too busy doing something else. But I didn't get it announced. But two of the witnesses that came down to say something to us about HB 200 have to go back tomorrow. And one of them can, or have to go back tonight, one of them can stay tomorrow. So, unless there's objections from the committee, or any member of the committee, I'd like to have Jim Sterling make a statement to us while he's here, and allow the committee to question him. Hearing no objection, we will proceed to continue then in the hearing of HB 200. Which is, I'll read the side of the bill, see if I can find it here. Which is an act relating to the individual rights of peace officers. So, at this time, Mr. Sterling, if you'd take the seat at the end of the table, and since we are recording electronically, before you begin your statement, if you'd say your name for the record so we can pick it up, if there's any proxies.
Before we start, I have a new bit of material in my file entitled Analysis of SB 115 and House Bill 200, and I don't know the source of that information.
Go ahead, Counsel.
Mr. Sterling, you
got
that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is James Sterling. I'm a police officer with the Municipality of Anchorage Police Department and also a member of the legislative committee with that association.
If you'd proceed at this time with a statement or any statement
right.
That you may or may not have regarding the bill, the committee would be most appreciative.
All right, sir. Thank you. The packet that is contained within the folders I brought down, it is an analysis that we have tried to put together for the two bills, which are worded the same. What we're trying to show is that as police officers, now we're not asking for any more rights that are afforded any person who is presently within the state of Alaska. All we're asking for is that those rights be laid down so that every person who is a police officer or the administration have guidelines to go by and that they know what those rights are. I guess one of the main reasons is that when operating under these type of guidelines, if an officer commits an infraction of personnel rules or something within his own department, we have found that at the Anchorage Police Department that when the investigation is complete, and if the officer is so terminated for that particular conduct or that act, it's a very thorough and intense investigation. And of the three that have happened in Anchorage within the last 4 months after we negotiated our new contract, that there was no grievance that was allowed to be filed because the investigation was done in a much proper manner. We feel that an officer, because of his status, should be in a position where he cooperates with the investigation because of the responsibility and the public image he does have. And unless he's being accused of a crime, whereas he would have the right to silence, this bill dictates he will cooperate under the knowledge that punitive action can take place if he does not cooperate with the investigation, which is much different than somebody that may work for a trucking firm, that when they asked him where he was for an hour, he says, I had a flat tire, and they pursued the matter. I mean, he made a statement, and that's all he's going to say. I mean, he does not have to cooperate with the investigation from there on. There is a problem that we recognize, that a lot of departments are small departments. There's 3, 4, and 5 people in those departments. In some cases, they're not able to negotiate a bill of rights as part of their contract of employment with the entity they're working for. 2 departments within the state, the Alaska State Troopers and the Anchorage Police Department, have negotiated almost the same rights that we're asking for the statewide peace officers that are in this bill. There are some departments that are in a position where their political body has opted out of negotiation because they were allowed to. It's awful hard to get a bill of rights or a standard in there if the entity you work for is not obligated to negotiate with you. This is being covered in another matter. We feel that we're not asking through this bill for any more rights than what the average citizen has. And if one were to take them in this package, I've included a recent district court decision from New York City, which is the 3rd page, which came out in the News and World Report January 17th. And the one that circled is disclosure laws. And that a challenge to a New York City disclosure law by firefighters and police officers was upheld in U.S. District Court. The court found that, and I quote, Americans do not lose their right to privacy by accepting public employment, unquote. And it says, at times, reasons for the public to know may exist, but these must be stated before information is dispensed. Well, we've included that in the Bill of Rights, where we have put down that matters are needed in order to regard the potential conflict of interest that they will be supplied. On the 4th page down, I've taken the bill, or the bill has been taken by section, and it's been crossed, and under Article 5 of the current Anchorage Police Department contract, within that contract, is wording to the same effect that the bill has. This can also be found in AFP contract. On the next page down, I interpreted the bill as to what it would mean to a police officer. And one part of the bill that says that the officer has to know or should be told what he is being investigated for, if it's an alleged complaint or if it's a criminal offense. Now all we say is that the officer shall be informed of the allegation or be given a copy of the complaint when he's first interviewed so he knows what's going on. Now we're not talking criminal at that point, let's talk internal. But by the same token, if you were late for work and your boss wanted to know why you were late, the first thing you say is why you were late. That's the allegation, you're late. At least you know what he's talking about. And it goes on through, and it even makes exception to what we feel is somewhat of an exception. It says that the interview will be during the officer's on-duty time unless the seriousness demands otherwise. Now, in police work, most departments work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. By reasonable, we're looking at it. If a man worked till 3 in the morning, and that's the time he got off shift, and he went home and a couple hours before he got to bed, to me, it'd be a little unreasonable to call him at 7:30 and say, be in the office at 8 o'clock. That'd be much the same as calling somebody at 12 o'clock at night who only went to bed at 10. When we're saying reasonable has to be used in conjunction with what hours that man may work, what shift he's on. And we went another way on this. We also, if you turn the page over, we compared the individual rights under this bill compared to rights that are extended to prisoners and institutions under the Clery Act, which is under Administrative Code 7AAC60. Now, admittedly, a person may be in an institution because he committed a crime and was found guilty of the crime and was sentenced to jail time. But if he was convicted of a misdemeanor crime and was serving 3 days, or 4 days, and he commits an infraction under their ruling of an infraction, which could be gambling or damage to state property under $50, which is a minor infraction, the institution is going to handle the matter internally. No charges will be brought. Well, if it's an internal handling, the administrative code sets out the guidelines that they must follow when they handle that matter. It's a totally separate thing from the infraction the man is in the institution for. And these are fairly strong guidelines that they must follow, along the lines that he has to be given written notice within 5 working days of what the original reported infraction was from the date of the infraction. And we're not saying, like I repeat myself, we're not saying we want any more rights, we're just saying we'd like it set down, and mainly because a lot of departments cannot negotiate. There may be a reason that they cannot negotiate. Either they're locked out, or the department's not strong enough, a three-man department. A recent case, and I've been told that I can expound upon this a bit, was the recent firing of the police chief in Dillingham. And to the best of my knowledge, after talking to the man less than 2 weeks ago, he still does not know why he was fired. Now, that man was a peace officer, even though he was the chief of police, he was still a peace officer. Other states have adopted this. The state of California has had it since 1976. The city of New York has a guideline that they must follow, which basically follows along the line. So far as having a representative present, both under 7 and 1860, the man can have a choice of an advocate present for any interview. And presently, if you belong to a union, in a union shop, if you're accused of something, you have the right to have that union representative present with you. To help either monitoring the contract or wherever the possible violation may be. There is one thing that is important, I think, and it is important to point out that I would have to look at the date, but I can be assured that for the last 4 months, and for time prior to that, both the City of Anchorage and the Alaska State Troopers have been operating with contractual agreements with their employees, with rights within those contractual agreements that are similar, and in some cases stronger than what are in this bill. An example being that the trooper's contract states that you can interview a man for 1.5 hour, you must take a 1/2 hour break, and you can interview him no more than 4 hours per day. This bill just says it will be done at a reasonable time.
The questions from committee members of Mr. Sterling, President Winton.
Mr. Sterling, do you see this bill as a document that's between the administration and its employees, or is it a bill that deals with how criminal or other actions are taken and what is a proper way for the state through its police departments to investigate this?
The bill, I don't think it's certainly not our opinion that the bill is designed to be a wedge between the employees and the administration. If an employee, be it a state trooper or an Anchorage City police officer or a Juneau police officer, if there are grounds to believe he's committed a crime, then the department should handle that investigation as a criminal investigation. And thus the man is afforded all the rights under the Constitution of a criminal investigation. The bill is designed that if it is determined to do the investigation internal for the man, the end result that is found to have committed the alleged offense, the man will suffer punitive action, such as time off without pay. It could be days, weeks. I've seen it as high as months plus. It could be just a letter of reprimand, which will go in the man's file. That investigation should be handled as a sensitive matter, and the man should be afforded the right to back his stance up. He shouldn't be put in a corner where that he's not informed of what the allegation is, number one, and he knows what it is so he can respond to it. The man should be able to have his, if he has a, an association and his representative doesn't help him because maybe he's not as familiar with the contract as the association representative is or the working conditions. The man should be aware of the punitive action that could happen if the allegations are found to be true. The man should be presumed innocent until it is in fact found that he did complete the allegation, not assume that he did it and have to justify that he didn't do it. It's been my opinion, and my, and I have seen after the time I've been in law enforcement that there are times when once the allegation is made, you are considered to have done the allegation until you find and finally prove yourself innocent.
Should we consider legislation in the light of the rights of an employee in relationship with his employer, or as a relationship between an employee who happens to be a police officer in relation to his employer?
I think in the case of a police officer, because of the credibility that that officer holds, because the standards he has to be maintained is the reason we're asking for this legislation. It's a lot different than a basic employee-employer relationship. The officer tells a much more stringent code than what a person, and I hate to use the phrase again, but we'll just say somebody who is in a different working capacity, a man who checks fire hydrants. And what we're saying is that his basic rights shouldn't be negotiated. He shouldn't have to negotiate his employer's rights.
For any employee?
As far as I'm concerned, no. My personal opinion, you're right, you shouldn't have to negotiate them. But if we look at it in the light, yes, you have to negotiate them, what are we saying then to the people that don't negotiate? I mean, and unfortunately, or fortunately, however you want to look at it, in this state, there are communities that do not have to negotiate, they have opted out of negotiation. So what do you say to those employees then?
Could you explain from the policeman's point of view the relationship between a criminal investigation and what you described as the punitive action?
Do they intertwine, or is there a clear cut if the crime committed, you know, internal punitive stuff isn't available, or vice versa?
There has been cases in the past where probably criminal action could have taken place in the case of quite a few dismissals that I can think of within my own department. But when the person investigating the alleged offense walked up and said, "Did you do it?" the guy, because the PI or the procedure manual says you will assist the investigation, says, "Yeah, I did it." Right there, the fifth's been violated. You can't use that against him in court. So the next step is, because his conduct was unbecoming a police officer, he's dismissed. In one case, it was a case of somebody who was misappropriating city gas.
But the investigator has the option of whether, even though a crime has been committed, has the option to pursue that internally versus
the decision. The decision is made by the administration of the department on how they're going to pursue them. They feel it. They may, in case of one investigation, the allegation came in and they went straight to the district attorney with what they had in the initial allegation and was decided to conduct a matter as a criminal case. They conducted it as a criminal case. They wound up with a lot of evidence, but not enough that would get a grand jury indictment. But because of the conduct, the man was dismissed. If you want to say it one way, it was a case where they tried to go criminal, they didn't have enough to get the indictment, so they turned around and came back and dismissed him because of punitive action based on the conduct that had taken place.
Are you aware of any cases where there has been a serious criminal offense in which a department has chosen to go internally and take punitive action as opposed to criminal action?
not serious that they did not try to go criminal first, but I am aware of a few investigations that because the man's right to the Fifth was violated and he was not read Miranda, that the investigation was messed up from the get-go, so there was nothing left but punitive. As it is now with the new Bill of Rights that's in the Anchorage Police Department's contract, the decision is made before you ever ask the man what's going on whether you're going to go punitive or whether you're going to go criminal. By then, if there is a potential for criminal, they have been going to the district attorney's office, which is fine by me. I don't want a rotten cop working on the department, and I don't want one that commits crime. But I also don't want the position that such as they investigate the alleged, say it's internal, they investigate the alleged infraction. The person's going to ask you about it, and you answer morally, and then you write a memo to the effect, and you try to get your witness to it. The bottom line may be, well, we still don't believe you. Take a polygraph. And then they may in turn, let's say, you know, depending on the emotions you're going through at the time, you may just, it may be interpreted that you didn't respond correctly during the polygraph examination, and that being the final piece, and you're dismissed because it all didn't come together right.
In investigating a crime, do you notify a suspect in writing that he's under investigation or something?
An example, hit and run occurs, we get the license number of the car, we send the registered letter to the owner of the car. You're Mr. Jones, you're the registered owner of vehicle XYZ, your vehicle was involved in a hit and run accident, would you please come to this department to discuss the accident? I investigate accidents and hit and runs as a matter of course in my job. First thing I do is I look at the suspect's vehicle, I go up, knock on the door. Is the owner of the car home? Yes. I'm Officer Sterling, I'm investigating a hit-and-run accident involving your vehicle. Wish to talk to you about it. Here's your Miranda rights. I read them their rights. They don't have to talk to me if they don't want it. But right up front, they know what I'm doing there.
If you have a suspect for murder, at the start of that investigation, you notify in writing that he's under investigation for murder?
I orally tell him if I arrest him for that crime.
Not arresting him, you're investigating him.
Well, if I have a suspect and I'm investigating, I may do a background, which would be like a letters check to find out who owns the car. At that point, no, I don't tell him what I'm doing because I haven't found them yet. But the law determines that once the man becomes suspect in your mind, before you do any questioning of that man, you must advise him his rights.
So if you initiate a discussion with a suspect in that instance, you notify him verbally or in writing, or you're under suspect for murder, where were you on Friday night?
Well, you say I'm investigating a homicide concerning so-and-so, where were you on this night? And that is the same as saying I'm interviewing you for a reason about that murder. It puts the man immediately on notice. But at that time, if he is suspect, you will have had to read him his Miranda rights and acknowledge that he knows what those rights are.
Can you do that in writing?
Yes, we have a Miranda advisement form, which by habit, if we're sitting down, I let him read it and sign it. And if not, I give him the Miranda card and get verbal acknowledgement on an interview that they understand it.
Good day, Richard.
Yes, Officer Sterling, I tend to question in regard to police ethics, because I don't like what it's many dollars. And I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask you to set in my mind so I get a clarified picture here, what we have. Now, apparently there's a reason for this bill to come out, for the protection of a police officer for his proper rights under law. Could you tell the committee here what some of the where the police officer has been denied these in the past before we instituted this type of a bill? And in what ways were your rights being denied before?
I have a personal case where I was involved that somebody I knew, very close, had committed a misdemeanor crime. And I was brought in and more or less questioned for an hour on the part of two captains. It's been alleged that, of which, as far as I was concerned, none of the allegations were true at all.
the final step as I walked out the door was, we may call you back to take a polygraph. And a big question mark, and out the door I went. There's been two or three investigations that have been completed that I know of within the Anchorage Police Department, and this is not recent, this is a while back, where they walked up to the man and they said, did you do this or did you do that? And the guy said yes or no, which would be a violation of the Fifth, but yet they used it under punitive, because in the within the department it says you cannot refuse to aid the investigation. There was another case where they handled it internally to a point, and then, well, gee, maybe we got enough here for criminal charges. I'm aware of that one. And there's others that I'm sure I'm not aware of, because I'm not privy to every investigation that goes on. This came about a lot because of the fact we recently negotiated and got the rights, in our Bill of Rights, within our own personal contract. AST has had them for quite a while. But the thing that concerns us is not Anchorage Police Department, and I must say it again, not AST. It is the smaller departments of 3 and 4 and 5 men throughout this state that perhaps cannot negotiate to put these in. And none of the rights are nothing that we wouldn't give anybody else. It's just sometimes, because of the sensitivity of your position, I mean, I go out and I meet 32 people in a day and I issue 32 tickets. Perhaps the 31st one had had a bad day at the office, and in his opinion, my mannerism was rude. Well, when he writes the letter, I have to not only try to remember the incident, but I have to answer the letter or the complaint.
Okay, under this House Bill 200, I'm sure you've had a chance to study it out. Can you see if anything in there that has been left out of this in protection of the police officer's rights, which has been deleted? In your estimation, pretty thorough?
I think it's a thorough bill, and I think it's good, because it does, even in that bill, state the officer will assist the investigation and he will disclose matters of privacy if there's a potential conflict of interest that's being looked into. So actually, in some ways, it's done away with, it's something you accept when you take the job on, such as here in the legislation, you must have disclosure of income and things along that line, which if you were working for JD Trucking, you wouldn't have to worry about that.
Okay, I got one question. We had some testimony here, I believe it was Friday, that I forget who the party was that called in, and I didn't think our police department, especially in Anchorage, was paid as high as they were. It's $6,000 per month. Is our Anchorage Police Department $72,000 a year?
No, sir. I was the one that made that statement, and that figure was based on the gentleman. I have to look at the contract, but the gentleman involved in that incident was a senior patrolman making top senior patrolman money, which probably equated out to about, with shift differential and a few other things, maybe close to $4,000. But the particular position that gentleman had, he worked nights, and because of a prior job, it was every day it was almost pure court. Now, when you take under the contract, which says you go to court and you're paid the overtime for the time you're there, in adding that up, at the potential income that was lost with that full week done, and we're talking gross figure, but the fact remains is that it was a fairly high punishment. At least I felt it was in my mind. I haven't seen many people that go to criminal court to come back with that type of fine for the offense that it was alleged to have committed.
Representative Foxman?
I want to go back to the point of the still confusing to me, criminal versus civil or internal investigation. Is the purpose of this legislation to set out the procedures only for internal investigations, or is the purpose to set out the procedures in criminal investigations of police officers?
The purpose of the legislation, as I see it, representatives, to set out guidelines by which an internal investigation will be accomplished without saying you have to do this and you have to do that, which would take away from what somebody else under a punitive investigation would be able to have, like the, not to confuse the issue. If you were charging me with a crime as a peace officer, I'd be the first one to jump up
and invoke every right I have, because I continually get it thrown at me every day on my job when I'm charging somebody with a crime. But when you are following a criteria of work where you have to keep a high standard and your exposure rate to the public is that as a peace officer, you are going to get complaints registered against you. I don't know anybody who can do this job and not offend somebody sometime. People are just not happy when they get a ticket.
I understand that, okay. But what I'm trying to get to is that
this is the internal.
This is for internal investigations only.
For internal investigations and a guideline to protect the officer's rights as just an average working person under those internal investigations.
Okay, when is the decision made that an investigation is going to be internal and not criminal?
Somewhere in the administration when they contact the district attorney or the municipal prosecutor's office, depending on the violation or the alleged offense.
After or before an interview, for example, with the police officer?
At the present, at APD, it is determined before the interview.
So the decision is made at the beginning,
yes.
Presumably immediately following a complaint, whether it's going to be investigated internally or criminally.
Correct, depending
and
on...
Your proposal then is to have a different procedure when it's proposed to be investigated internally. A different procedure than a criminal investigation.
Yes, because in fact what happens is under an internal investigation, this mandates the officer will aid the investigation itself.
Right. But there are other ways that this is different than a criminal investigation. This procedure you would propose in this bill would provide protections for a police officer that would not be available to someone in a criminal investigation. Do you agree with that?
No, I think it provides less protection for the police officer than somebody in a criminal investigation.
Well, does a person have a private citizen have a right to know who's making a charge against them?
When the citizen is advised of a criminal charge being placed against him, number one, current procedure requires that if he's arrested on the spot, such as I arrest you out of your car, that there is an immediate bail hearing before a judge.
Within 24 hours.
Depending on the locale, I would say yes, but in Anchorage, both for us and AST, it's as fast as you're...
But we're not talking about Anchorage, of course.
That's,
you're talking about small
correct.
Communities. What I'm trying to establish is some of the procedures available for somebody who commits an alleged crime on the street versus a police officer charged with committing that same alleged crime.
Okay.
Fact is, the police officer under this legislation, page 1, line 27, would get a complaint signed by the complainant.
Okay, and this
does a private citizen get that?
Yes,
in
sir.
A criminal complaint.
In the criminal complaint, number one, when the person's arrested, he's informed of the charges.
But he doesn't get the name of the complainant necessarily.
At the time he's arrested, if it's by me, he's looking at the name, and I say, you're under arrest for.
If it's that's in that circumstance.
Okay.
Not
the other circumstance, if the man's arrested through the use of a summons, that is the written complaint. If he's arrested through the use of a warrant, that's a written complaint. The only time he doesn't get a written complaint if it's a spontaneous arrest at the scene.
The important distinction I'm trying to make is between a formal written complaint and something which is signed by the complainant. I know that there are cases where there are anonymous complainants. We've talked about the search officer. The question is it for a citizen?
Yes, they know who the complainant is when they're placed under arrest.
Well, I respectfully suggest that that's not the case. That's not what the statute provides, and that's not the practice as I understand it. Let's ask about witnesses. Now, this allows a witness to participate in the interview. Witness or other person, does a private citizen arrested and interviewed under a suspicion situation, under a Miranda situation, have the right to have a witness who is not an attorney participate in the interview?
He has the right to have, I believe it's a representative there, and that was, if I can just check in 1 second, sir. The right of an employee to have a representative present interview.
And we're talking about a criminal
right.
charge. That's what I'm trying to
right.
focus on.
Right. He has the right to an attorney, and he has the right
believe he does have a right to have a representative there. Because an attorney at a minimum, if he can't afford to have an attorney present, the state will provide it.
Right. I understand that. In the question is a witness, right, you know, a friend, an advocate, or a supporter.
Right, but we're talking in a criminal charge.
Right. The statute says no. The statute says you can call a friend if you want. That's the way you get your lawyer down there. But you don't have a right to just anybody sitting in and participating with you in your interview.
Okay.
If you have an attorney, the attorney doesn't,
the attorney
theoretically doesn't have a right to participate. But that's an interesting little thing about interviews. How about the question of reasonable hours? An interview taking place during reasonable hours, does a private citizen have that right?
I believe in most cases a police officer tries to extend it. If you work,
but
first of all,
right? Is it a right?
I don't think it's listed as that you will, it's mandated that you will interview somebody at quote unquote reasonable hours.
I agree with you that most police officers will do it at reasonable hours. Let's not dispute that. I'm just talking about what the rights are now.
Okay.
How about the right to be paid during the interview?
No, I don't think the police department pays people for the interview.
On the flat. I would not wish to grant that. Let me talk about polygraph for a second. I honestly don't know, and Mr. Potter testified, and I didn't quite get it clear from that. In a criminal investigation of a private citizen, I understand the polygraph is not admissible, but can you require a person to take one even though the evidence may later never be admitted in court?
No.
In a criminal investigation?
No.
You cannot stand for an employment situation.
Pre-employment, yeah. And as it stands now by statute, after employment.
Disciplinary proceedings affecting police officers,
yes,
after employment.
You can request that a polygraph be taken. And the way the Bill of Rights was going to the Alaska State Troopers is that you may not require that it be taken, and if it's not taken, you can make no note of it, no mention of it, no recording of it. We personally, as the police department, do not have that in our particular Bill of Rights section of our contract.
And I'm trying to focus in on the difference between an internal and a criminal investigation here. What you say is the decision is made at the beginning of an investigation, whether it's going to be criminal or civil, and if it's internal. And if it's going to be internal, these procedures should apply. And if it's going to be criminal, other procedures should apply?
Standard criminal procedures.
Is there a different type of investigation in criminal cases? I'm having trouble.
Yeah, well,
how about the officer that was charged with drunk driving? Did he get investigated under the criminal procedures or under the internal procedures in your country?
As existed, I believe, would say it would be internal at that time.
Why was the decision made in that case to investigate internal rather than prosecuting?
I don't know. In the rank and file, I'm told that was made later, doesn't it?
I
can't answer your question.
You can't answer that question.
I don't make the decision.
I'm curious why a private citizen would normally be prosecuted for drunk driving. There is no other alternative to a private citizen being prosecuted in this situation. Police officer wasn't prosecuted. He wasn't even investigated for coming to prosecution.
I don't know. I didn't make that decision. I can't answer your question in as much as how the decision was made. I can tell you that the decision was made.
How about the late alleged rape case that I read about in the paper a couple of years ago? Is that case investigated criminally or internally?
That one was investigated criminally.
What was the resolution of that?
Not enough evidence for grand jury indictment. There were places for grand jury, no indictment.
And was that because the investigation was screwed up? I can use the term.
No, as a matter of fact, that's because investigation was done within the contract.
And it was a effective investigation,
yes. I believe there
were no minor problems or anything else, and no prosecution was resulting.
That's correct. Happens in a lot of non-police department-oriented crimes. If you don't get the indictment, you don't get the indictment.
Do you think that this kind of legislation is going to increase the number of cases that are handled internally as opposed to criminally?
No, I don't believe it will. In fact, I think it may alter to where more are handled criminally than what are handled internally.
I agree.
The checkpoint guidelines that have to be followed, if you're going to make a decision, you know, before you could take, let's say, you have a complaint and you work it to a point that all of a sudden it's enough developed that you say, gee, this is criminal nature, but by then, you totally walk over it all the way anyway. And by the time you made your decision, it's set up again because it's demanded, it's a demand of this investigation to not be used against them.
And if you accomplish that same thing by doing the same way as you do in a criminal investigation,
except for
that, you have a Joe Blow, a police officer, and giving you a criminal right.
Once you give them the right, he doesn't have to assist you. Once you give them the Miranda right, you say, you're under investigation for this. The second step you have to have, you're going to be charged with him.
If I understand that correctly, the effect of this legislation would be to encourage more criminal investigations rather than internal investigations?
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that would be the effect of this legislation?
I think the effect of the legislation. I think the effect of the legislation is number one, going to ensure that investigations that are done, whether internal or criminal, are done thorough and done good. And if you hire a bad officer, the bad officer is either fired or he is criminal for whatever he was alleged to commit, rather than have messed up investigation into where you can't charge him criminally because you walked all over his rights, or rather you dismissed the man and because you didn't allow him to have witnesses and you didn't allow him to present witnesses to the alleged internal charge, that the city suffers a freedom, or the municipality, or whoever it is, and that's where they're paying a year's reinstatement pay. Attorney fees that have to be accomplished. What we're looking for is very basic is you're going to do it and do it right.
Let me take a hypothetical here. Let's talk about the way to talk about it as a hypothetical. I'll use my word while I'm doing it. The investigation begins with a criminal investigation. And that's reasonable that they started with a criminal investigation or a deal with
it.
They go to a grand jury, they don't get an indictment because they don't have adequate information. At that point, what happens to an internal action against that officer if this deal is not? You haven't satisfied the provisions of this. So you can't get an internal or either?
At that particular point, you decide to come back and take a look at and investigate the man's conduct, depending on what the criminal investigation turned up. There may be an extra that the man, according to the procedures of this department, his conduct was way more than that was acceptable for an officer on duty.
And if you got that information in violation of the procedures,
not
to the internal interview, so you don't have to be coming in.
And you do not see what the field that he was interviewed with the department telling the team, once he was judged in the the thing about it is that there's a whole book about an intricate procedure that these officers have to follow. Maybe he did not commit something that was enough to convict him of a criminal offense, but the fact remains that maybe he did violate 4, 5, and 6 procedures that were found to be just blatant violations during the course of the investigation around the alleged offense.
So if you conducted a criminal investigation, you violated this bill, therefore you can't listen to me.
If you just conducted a criminal violation, man, you did not violate any of this bill. This bill requires on a criminal investigation, on an internal investigation, that the man is mandated to assist you in the investigation. Well, if you're investigating an internal, you're not mandated to assist you.
There's an allegation that you just raped somebody, and I go in and I give you the Miranda right, and I say, you don't have to cooperate, and you get away, and do whatever you want to do, you follow the Miranda procedures, and you follow the normal constitutional procedures we say, the criminal investigation.
So,
I took it to a grand jury and they went in there. And then, what happened? The fact is, I have conducted an investigation that violates this bill. Because I have not given you the authority to cooperate, that's been a criminal determination. I mean, I have not force you to cooperate, mm-hmm. somebody that's using you not to cooperate, mm-hmm. how can I get the intent?
Any investigation will cooperate with us, the investigation. But I don't know if you know how to do that. Because there are cases in the past where the administration, because of maybe even a personality conflict, we decide to dismiss somebody. I can cite you an example where a man was called in, told, signed a letter of recommend, was written a file over the act of taking somebody's evidence. And it is kind of a thing. So once the man listed 8 witnesses for the Department of Energy, in conducting an investigation to not one of the 8 witnesses that the man listed were contacted. And that was in violation of the law procedures, and what's wrong is this bill mandates that those people be contacted.
I don't know much problem with those. The truth is that they are basically asked to be handled in terms. And I believe in employer rights in that area. The only problem in my mind comes when we have something that rises to the level of a criminal offense, for which an individual person doesn't have some of the rights in here, and a police officer will. Those are the ones that are the problem. We need to have due process rights and internal investigation. Difficulty comes when a police officer is alleged to rape somebody, and what protections that police officer is going to receive in an investigation, or is alleged to be drunk driving,
under,
or whatever.
Under criminal law, the police officer and the alleged and the citizen, both alleged for the same offense, have the same rights. Under criminal investigation, correct?
Not a pistol attack.
But when we take and change and we say, okay, there's not enough for criminal prosecution, let's do it internally, I don't see the owner of JD Trucking saying, well, gee, Joe got off because they didn't let the grand jury. Let's do it internally when it comes back to work. That's what I'm talking about. In that case, that person has got a lot more rights than the police officer, because the police officer has to go back to his place of employment where he may have violated procedures, and now he's going to be charged, if you would, internally for conduct on becoming a police officer, because there was enough circumstantial evidence there to support that he really wasn't working quite right, but yet, not enough for criminal offense. I don't see the guy that works in the penitentiary who is charged for armed violence, goes to court, is found not guilty, does not go back to work, and suffer repercussions because of what happened. If he lost his driver's license, maybe so. But the police officer has to worry about the internal investigation because of his conduct or because of his act. Even if he wasn't charged criminally, he still got that to take, which is one more step than the average citizen has to take. I mean, we have people that are running the streets that have been convicted of crimes, found guilty, and are out on bail. They don't take any further repercussions in most cases. The thing I'm trying to get across is that once you have been found either not guilty or there is not enough to proceed criminally, very few of those people suffer any further repercussions because of that original criminal charge that was placed on them. But that is not so in the case of a police officer. He's in AFC, he's in special, or he's in anxious, because you still have the internal conduct procedures that he's worked under that gives that administration the right to take senior action. And what we're asking for is to protect them from student action. So my position is no, it doesn't give the option anyone likes any other decision.
Thank you much, Mr. Sterling, for taking the time to come down today. And it's my understanding that you have to be back today, but Liz Cruz will be here with us tomorrow, and we'll get the proper announcements on the floor tomorrow so we can continue the investigation and testimony until that time. But,
thank you
much, and we'll try to close up the HB 200 at this time, and we take it up tomorrow at the time of next week. And if the Peace Officer Association is saying, I'll see you go ahead.
Well, I can't talk about this for the community.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is the appropriate time.
Well, I think tomorrow after you listen to her, it's the appropriate time to do it. Doug Wedding, Steve is here, and we're back to the House Bill 1. Back to the low numbers. And back to the legal scheduling event. Everything to do is awesome, and we are recording electronically. I need for you to place your name to a record and try and make a statement with regard to House. Plus, the substitute for House Bill 1, this is an act related to landlords and tenants.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Representative Mr. B. Sponsor of the House Bill number 1. We have reworked House Bill 1 to reflect some of the changes recommended in the Judiciary Committee on February the 25th. We'd like to offer two amendments to the Judiciary Committee for consideration. The bill has been drafted to reflect the two amendments. The section has been renumbered to correspond to the amendment. Also, note page 2, line 15 is the redraft of AFC 4.20.020 should be AFC 4.03.020. Also, in fact, the draft layer is just a minute. I should please refer to the redraft bill of HB 1 and its finding the folder, amendment number 1. The new section, AS 09.45.085, is amended by adding a new paragraph to reinforcement. And if you can note there, if there I won't read it. I will say, however, addressing that the amendment is offered to assist the plaintiff in settling this case. As it stands now, if a landlord is an example, we proceed against the tenant, he's holding over, that is staying in the place. Without the landlord's permission, the landlord needs to first receive a judgment, come to court, and then go to the court of statutes to file an additional form or forms to enforce the judgment. In some cases, the delay in action results in the tenant disappearing before the correct forms can be served timely. And this would alleviate, this amendment would alleviate the additional cost of filing the additional form. In other words, you can go to the sheriff, if any judgment, the sheriff can go and do his job according to the court's ruling. I don't know whether I should stop now and ask for a question on it or continue.
Go ahead.
Section 3, page 1, line 16 through 23, which is amendment number 2. That's section 3, page 1, line 16 through 23. Alaska Statute 34.03 is amended by adding a new section to read the changes in terms and conditions of rental agreement. The landlord may and the tenant may change the laws and terms of a rental agreement if the changes are not prohibited by law. And unless both the landlord and tenant agree to a change in a rental agreement, the agreement remains in effect under its original terms and conditions, including the provisions relating to rent and the rights and obligations of the parties until the agreement is terminated and under 3403.290 or another law. Now I offer this amendment number 1 to the Judiciary Committee. Is that number 1 or number 2? I guess that's number 2. I offered this amendment number 1 to the Judiciary Committee on the 25th.
In order to correspond to the bill section, I am now offering this as amendment number 2. I guess you'll have to figure that out, Mr. Chairman. This is simply in place of the letter of intent by the Labor and Commerce Committee to define AS 3403.298 in detail regarding the 45-day notice as it applies to a rental increase. Gives further clarification as to what transpires if a landlord or tenant makes substantial or material changes to a rental agreement. Does not, however, change the bill, but defines Alaska Statute 3.290B, period. The landlord, for an example, gives a tenant a notice of a rental increase, and the tenant does not approve of the rent increase, then the tenant can give his notice as defined in 3.403.290. Now this is called the 3.403.290B is under the heading of a periodic tenancy and holdover. And incidentally, you will find these amendments in your packets, if you can get down through the bottom of the box. Now amendment number 3. This is on page 1, line 26 and 27, and page 2, line 1, 2, and 3. Section 4, which was section 2, AS 3403.270, was amended by adding a new subsection to read: the rental agreement is terminated and the failure to provide the notice is willful or not in good faith, the landlord may recover an amount not to exceed 1.5 times the actual damages. Now, failure by the tenant to provide the notice required under that statute is presumed to be willful and not in good faith. Now, these changes are offered as amendment number 3, and the key word here is presumed. The burden of proof lies with the tenant to prove that his intentions were in good faith. This shortens the judicial process in some circumstances, and it is up to the tenant to explain why he did not give notice or had good reason for not giving notice. An example, an emergency operation, a death in the family, etc. Until that time, the court presumes that the tenant failed to give notice and the landlord can proceed with the recovery of the premises. Mr. Chairman, those are the 3 amendments that I offer to the Judiciary Committee this afternoon. I realize, however, you're going to have to dig into it pretty deep in order to connect it up. But I'm sure in the wisdom of the committee chairman and the committee, they will be able to do that very nicely. I would say, Mr. Chairman, if there are any questions, I will attempt to answer them. I do have my legal counsel with me, etc.
The committee took, we had a teleconference and testimony from the whole list of witnesses and anchors, and almost unanimously, if I remember right, with the exception of one or two persons that great discomfort voiced with the 45 days instead of the 30 days, that is written into, depending, I guess, on which copy you look at, line 20, where you have a
General.
Almost unanimous discomfort, of course, but it's on line 20 on page 1. In the Labor Commerce Committee, they took out 30 and inserted 45, and almost unanimously, everyone wanted 45 taken out and 30 put back in.
General. I have no objection, nor would my counsel have any objection on it whatsoever. The people would feel more comfortable with 30 days rather than 45, then I would leave it to the wisdom of the committee.
That's only one person out of 9 supported the 30 days.
Chairman, what's the committee's substitute response to the House Bill 1? They were promised with the 3 amendments. Where would that appear?
Is it in written form in front of you as a rewritten bill?
Well, I have it. Is that what this is?
Yep.
between line 20 and 21, I don't see it on that.
Well, I was looking on the original for reuse of Billy up in this case here, and
they
see on line 2, the same thing on line 6 on the rewritten part.
Yeah.
It's that over 30 to 45 days, and it, I think that was probably you were here for all the talk down with the mountain, but it seemed to be a huge
deal. I didn't remember that part of it.
Yeah. It seemed to be a huge deal, like a really important.
I'd like to go through these by foot and just start the first one on enforcement. The effect, and I'm looking at this one, the effect of this, as I understand it, would be to eliminate the requirement of a writ of assistance or other order to report the judgment. Okay.
You're talking about the judgment. Yes. What it would do would be to say, okay, in the case that I've got a judgment against somebody, I haven't got to go down and I haven't got to file all the rest of the necessary things and all the things to do it. Yes, I would say that's what it does. And I guess that's something else.
I wanted to explain how it works, and my argument is basically going to be that that's the procedure that's used in every other piece of civil litigation, and it would be opposed to changing it specifically for one of those kind of ugly arguments. But tell me, what happens now is you receive a judgment of a court that says, Mr. Tennant, you do not have the right to be there, please. That's the judgment. The judgment says leave. At that point, you take the judgment, you say to the attorney, you say when you leave. And they say, I'll meet them tomorrow, because the judgment says it, or I'm appealing. Or the hell with it. I don't believe in this piece of the paper, I'm not going to leave. That's what happens. In the third alternative, in the third case, when you don't get cooperation from the Senate, once you've gotten the judgment, then you go back to them and you ask for an order to execute the judgment, or a writ of assistance, an order to the state trooper to go out and move them from their house, physically, with force if necessary. That's the procedure. Now, that's the same procedure that you would use if you had a deputy coming for it. You file lawsuits, say the judge owes you $1,000. You file, the judge says you're right, the judge owes you $1,000. Then you go to Joe Blow and say, okay, the court agrees with me, I want my $1,000. Joe Blow either says, I'll pay it next week, or I'm not going to pay it because I'm waiting to keep it paid. And then you get a writ of attachment or a garnishment. This is a whole long way of deciding. This is the same procedure that's used in any other lawsuit. It's a two-stage procedure. One of the reasons that there are two stages to the procedure is because most of the time, issuing the writ or the garnishment or the attachment, whatever it is, isn't necessary. And the court procedures recognize that. But most people pay their bills, and most people do what the judge or the court says they're supposed to do. So I guess I would argue that in not every case is aware that this is necessary, and in not every case should you immediately order the trooper to remove someone from their house from that property. It does all
Can we have counsel would like to comment to that too?
I worked on that a little bit. I was trying to go over for the talking with Dave Donnelly, one of the judge's staff, and his experience has been, in the very situation you're describing for a conflict committee, that the judge can, well, indeed, give it a writ of assistance, which all judges do, of course, numerous times. But if it happens to be on a weekend or at 4:30 p.m. or whatever, they take the writ of assistance that the judge has signed to the troopers to get the troopers to move the violating tenant out in the street or whatever it is that they do. And the troopers say, oh, we can't use that, we've got our own form. You'll have to go back Monday and get another form because we don't use this form. That seems to be Mr. Donnelly's experience with the class, and that's why he thought it would be best to eliminate the problem in this fashion. I don't know that it would. That was one idea that was put forth by him.
I have some considerable expertise in this area, and I would submit that's not the general thing. The other thing I would say is if I'd like to hear that testimony because I
think I disagree with it in terms of what procedures are available in the court. But more importantly than that, that's the same procedure used in every other piece of civil litigation. And I'm just not sure that it's necessary in every case to run through that shortcut. The one thing I'll bet if the troopers knew about this, they'd be very concerned about their workload.
Mr. Chairman,
there's any move
through the chair. Representative Claxton is correct in that, and as far as the knowledge that I can get out of it. I guess it really comes down to a matter of policy. Do we want them to do this or do we not? Do we want to make it easier on the one who has been damaged, or do we want to put them through more hoops again to get it? In the case of the judge decreed that, in a particular case I happen to know of, that someone owed this person some money and decreed and got a judgment against her. Or got a judgment so that she could obtain the money. Now we've got to go through more hoops in order to get the money. And maybe by that time the money is spent, maybe by that time they take off. And this eliminates it. When the judge says you will pay the money, it seems to me that 5 minutes after the judge says you ought to pay the money, you ought to pay it. Why do we have to go through these legal hoops all around and for people that really don't understand the law? To begin with, all he knows is the judge says, I get my money. Now, I want it today after tomorrow, or the judge says, by this date, okay, boom. He wants it. He doesn't care about how many troopers it's going to take to do it. He just wants it done. So, again, it goes back to the policy of the Judiciary Committee as to how you feel a policy should be addressed in this case.
I agree it's a policy matter. I suspect it's a broader policy matter than just bill. I guess I would ask two things. First of all, should we ask the troopers to assist in the amendment, or position paper, whatever, however they issue the notice. Secondly, I think you'll find that it also requires an amendment of the court.
We have just a note from the Department of Law. I thought we had two on this.
Well, even if you had one from troopers, it wouldn't apply to this amendment, because this fairly new, I think. Right?
Yeah.
I'm not disagreeing with you that in most cases they ought to pay right away. I'm just saying I know of the circumstances where a writ of assistance is not necessary. People do cooperate, and why go through that unnecessary step that the troopers involved in? It's like every judgment for payment of a debt. In that judgment, you attach their bank account. It doesn't make any sense. Why don't you let them pay the debt before you decide to attach their bank account? It's exactly the same procedure.
Mm-hmm. Sure, wouldn't that, I don't know how to phrase this, but wouldn't that just come under the auspices of good judgment? Certainly, if a guy says he's going to pay me after I got a judgment against him, I'm going to wait for the payment. If he doesn't pay then, I'm going to do something else. But I think it's in the judgment of that person to either force the guy's hand that owes him the money by going through the rest of the thing, or let. I don't think it's going to affect that many people. It's going to affect the people that really say the hell with you in your terms, sir. I'm not going to pay it anyway. Then you can zap him right off the bat, and I think that's what we're trying to do. We're not looking for that. The person says, yeah, I'm wrong, and I got judgment against me, I'm going to pay it. You know, I think there are very few of them who want to tangle into that. I thought perhaps this clarified it quite a bit, but in the favor of the person who has the judgment, regardless of whether the landlord is there. And so I guess we could tie this thing up in legal jargon for the next 20 years, and still not get one that he's enjoying.
You could ask on that we get some information from the troopers, and I think if we are going to adopt the amendment, I think we need a court rule. We have a specific court rule on addition. Let me ask on the second amendment, the changes in terms and conditions of rental agreements. Isn't there already, and I didn't have time to find it, I think there's already in the landlord tenant act the procedure for doing that. The section 020 terms and conditions of rental agreement specifies what they can agree to, what they can't agree to, what they may not agree to, and there's a provision somewhere else that says you can't waive your rights under this chapter, don't we have a lot of duplication here with those two files? Why do I have to have it in the law?
Funny, I may refer to the advice.
Let me read one. Let's get that self and join you there. That's right. That might help you and the committee.
I mean, I think, let me just say, since here, I think there always has been a question under the Act whether a notice to increase rent is a termination of tenancy or a change in terms in the notice required. But I think in solving that problem, you may have run into conflict with another provision of the statute.
My
name is Pamela Cook, and I work with the Legislative Affairs Legal Division. Representative Cox, and I think you are essentially correct. 3402.05 is a statement of the existing law, as I understand it, in that right now, a rental agreement cannot be unilaterally changed. A landlord cannot change an agreement, neither can a tenant. All you can do is propose to change an existing agreement. And one of the things that a person may use to try to coerce agreement on the part of the other party is to then threaten to terminate the rental agreement. However, there is a great deal of confusion among people who are renting property and among landlords as to what actually happens when someone does propose some type of a material change, whether it be no pets and no kids allowed, or whether it be an increase in rent. This essentially is a statement to you that that sort of thing is a proposal. Until two parties agree, you haven't changed the rental agreement, as I understand it. If a landlord offers to increase the rent and the tenant, unless he gets agreement to that rental increase, the rental agreement will continue under the terms of the old rental rate until one party or the other terminated it. And there are several steps. There are several different ways that a rental agreement can be terminated under the law, and that's specified with clarity, I think, in the landlord's opinion.
Let me try to follow up. I suspect we're roughly agreed on the goal. I think we do complicate things by this section, and I would just again refer you to 020 and section 130. 020 specifically talks about what can and can't go into a rental agreement, and section 130 specifically talks about how you change rules and regulations. Now, both of those appear also in section 825 and somewhat inconsistent. You said it's consistent, I don't think it's quite consistent. Certainly not consistent in section 130. So, the first comment is that I think we're all in the same ballpark, but I think just adding section 825 will create internal inconsistency in the Act and very much complicate the question, not solve it. So, really, 130.
If I may, also represent the section, I'm inclined to agree with you that 3403025 was probably never entirely necessary. Part of the problem came up in people's minds from some of the earlier committees that I attended about how to deal with the concept of a month-to-month tenancy that's going to require a 45-day notice, a longer period of termination. And this was something that gave a lot of people conceptual problems. Even though right now, in the case of a week-to-week tenancy, a person is obligated to give a longer termination notice than the period of the tenancy. So that was part of the reason that this particular amendment was proposed, was to solve that in people's minds. A lot of people didn't understand how it would work, how you could have a month-to-month tenancy and still receive the 45-day notice to terminate.
But I think we resolved that problem by going from 45 back to 30. 425 might not be necessary.
It probably would not be if the committee took that step.
I would like to say that even if 025 isn't necessary,
I think we've still got the problem with the notice to increase rent, for example, and whether that's a notice to terminate. It's all very confusing, but I don't think 025 solves it. That's the main point.
I don't think it is that confusing. Going back to 30 does clarify it and does help you to rewrite that, right, Pam?
of going back to three. On that particular issue,
yes.
You're correct. But as far as the question in people's minds of whether any change, any notice of change, whether it be a rent increase or whether the landlord comes to the tenant and says, you can't use my garage anymore, whether that is effectively a notice to terminate remains a question that will probably have to be solved on a case-by-case basis, looking to see whether or not the tenant, whether the two parties ever reached an agreement on that. And that's the sort of thing that almost always needs to be adjudicated on a case-by-case basis when you're trying to determine whether there was agreement between two people rather than a unilateral action taken by one party and attempted to be forced upon the other.
So you still believe that what you've got there marked as Amendment 2 is needed then anyway?
No, I would agree with Representative Clarkson. I think whether the committee stayed with 45 days or 30 days, probably Section 3 is not needed as a matter of law, that the hazy issues that come up have to be resolved on a case-by-case basis, and I'm not sure that it really ever added anything other than a lot of comfort for people who weren't understanding a lengthy termination requirement. However, if the committee is contemplating going back to the 30-day period, I think that there's even less reason to include Section 3. And in any case, Section 3 was designed, I believe, to be a statement of the existing law rather than a change to that law. So to the extent that it inadvertently makes changes, it might be safer to delete it.
Okay, Pam, would you have any problem if we redrafted this, excluded that, and instead addressed that through a letter of intent?
I would have no problem with that, and I don't know that a letter of intent is necessary.
If you have problems with gray areas, it must be resolved by doing it. If you don't think that a letter of intent will resolve that problem that you have.
Mr. Chairman. To me, a letter of intent, is that an enforceable thing, or is that just show the intent of it? So what would the letter of intent really do?
Well, it depends on who you listen to. If you listen to the current Attorney General now, when he's come down here, he seems to think, or has stated at least before this committee on the record, that he's almost willing to accept letters of intent as part of the bill drafted. He's willing to use those as determining devices and determining the intent or how he's going to interpret the enforcement of the law. And that's basically what he said. Representative Clarkson?
I can't resist just a little pitch on letters of intent. The Supreme Court has clearly said the letter of intent is not binding and is not even particularly good evidence of legislative history unless and until it's been approved by a majority vote of both houses. If you do that, why don't you put it in the law?
That's right.
So I just think that there's a real limited value in letters of intent, particularly in substantive legislation like this. I agree with you.
You just asked the question, and I think that's what Gorsuch tried to tell us, that the letter of intent would be used. So the fact he was blaming the prior legislation for not including letters of intent, so he could discover how to interpret this as law.
I don't want to prolong the questioning on this one. My point is that if the decision of the committee is to leave it in, I'm going to make some strong arguments that it's inconsistent with existing law, and if you want to take it out, then it isn't a problem, although...
Mr. Chairman, in view of the circumstances, I'm just proposing the amendments, and I would have no objection if that particular amendment were left out if the committee feels more comfortable with it.
What the committee will do will be to redraft a bill that somewhat meets everybody's philosophical need, and we're talking about 16 amendments here when we get ready to do it. The council needs to make
it. I just wanted to comment in relation to the council's comment that this session, especially with the years that we went back to 30 days instead of 45, I think that some of the testimony during the teleconference was to the effect that I don't know how sure it was, but the impression I got from the testimony was that if the 45 days goes in, then those landlords who charge first or last month rent will be actually charging 3 month rent when they can move in to cover 2 45-day periods. So there won't be any sort of foul up. They won't be out of pocket any money that the landlord county tenant takes. And that was one of the big objections, was asking if it might even work a hardship financially to potential tenants if they had to put up two 45-day periods of rent before they move in. I think that was a risk of some of that testimony, but I think the I think one person who testified along those lines would be happy to see them go back to 30 days. However, they like the termination date, just say another one is going to be
there. Kevin, I feel very comfortable with that situation. I wish I had said it.
Since the balance of the committee seems to be in philosophical agreement with the rest of the bill, we all instruct our committee council to both you and Pam so that we get this thing in some form so that we can address it tomorrow and there be any intent to dispose of these regulations early on tomorrow. And we'll just continue it, and I'll try to make the proper announcements on the floor so that we can do it tomorrow and handle it very quickly.
And you want us to redraft this?
Yeah, I'll have our council work with Pam and with you and redraft this thing and leading out the emergency fight wherever we find.
One, if you're closing this up here, one thing that there was testimony on, and I haven't had a chance to talk to Representative Abood about this, page 2 of the original bill, I guess it ends up being the last section, the presumed or the violated section.
Mm-hmm.
There was testimony, I believe, with a request to insert after possession the language or gives notice of termination of tenancy. Basically, all those things are ways that a person retaliates. To increase the rent, decrease the service, brings or threatens to bring an action for possession. The other one that logically fits in that area is giving a notice of termination of tenancy, and yet it's not there. I think it's a gap. I think it fits within the intent of the section to say that you also can't retaliate by giving them a notice of eviction. Yeah, there was testimony, but it never got another guy.
Then there was testimony that it was really fast.
I don't believe so, Mr. Chairman. I think that perhaps the council should work this thing out and figure this thing out. And if it isn't, it might be well to add it. I'm not sure. I think that's a good question.
Those events being so, Doug, can you have any problems being able to redraft the simple thing that quickly?
What do you do, Mr. Chairman?
Well, if we did it by, you know, shooting it at 1:30 tomorrow or Wednesday.
Oh, there would be no problem with that.
Okay.
By Wednesday.
Well, I don't know, 1:30 tomorrow, if you can't, it doesn't really make a difference yet. Whatever you tell me, you can do it, that's what I would ask.
I can certainly do it if I can get the changes turned up today. I can certainly get it for you by tomorrow.
I would say the changes are all turned up now. We'll have a clean bill and auction tomorrow. If there's nothing very clear to come before the committee, we'll adjourn till 1:30 tomorrow.